of war, war incipient, and treason at the heart of her realm. Yes, my lady, I said softly, it is true. She was silent a moment, accepting the truth of it. I saw in that moment something else surfacing in her, a dreadful resolve that she drew from some inner depths, hardening the planes of her lovely young face and firming the line of her mouth. Isandra de la Courcelle would stare unblinking at this terror. I remembered then that she was the daughter of Roland de la Courcelle, whom de Launay had loved. "And my uncle?" Isandra asked, coming back to herself. "The Duc Lanvert?" Still kneeling, I shook my head, then rose in the fluid movement I had first learned at Sirius House. "To the best of my knowledge, Barquier Lanvert had naught to do with it, Your Highness. He and de Launay had settled the score between them." "Is it true that he had Dominic Stregardze killed?" Isandra de la Courcelle would be ruthless in acknowledgment of the truth. I saw that much. "I believe it to be true," I said quietly. "The name of your mother's murderer was the coin de Launay paid for the truce between him and the Duc Lanvert. He reckoned it worthwhile to protect you from the same fate, Your Highness." She absorbed it without blinking. "And you gathered this intelligence for him?" "I had a companion. We both did." Grief sank its claws into my heart, fresh again now that I was home in the city. "His name was Alcuino de Launay. It was he who garnered the Stregardze's name. He died with my lord de Launay." "You weep for him?" Isandra looked curiously at me, saddened. "I wish I had known him better. I wish there had been time." She glanced at the door through which the guard had left, then rose, beckoning. "Come here." We followed her then, the four of us and her guard, through two doors into a cloistered bedroom. It was heavily guarded, and two elderly castellans stood aside at her command, opening the door. Jocelyn took care not to meet their eyes. The Dauphine stood in the doorway and looked within. Pressed close behind her, we gazed over her shoulder. Ganelon de la Courcelle, the King of Terre d'Ange, lay in a canopied bed, his face waxen and unmoving, fallen into deep lines. He was more ancient than I remembered. At first I thought he slept the long sleep of death. Then I saw his breast rise and fall, disturbed by a long breath. "So lies my grandfather, the king," Isandra said softly, twisting a heavy gold ring on the finger of one hand. I knew it. It was Roland's signet, on which de Launay had sworn his oath. "So lies the ruler of our fair realm." She backed out of the doorway, and we hastened to get out of her way. "He suffered a second stroke in this bitterest winter," she murmured, closing the door and nodding to the castellans, who took up their pose, arms crossed at ease. "I have been ruling in his name. Thus far the nobles of the realm have endured my pretense. If we stand upon the brink of war, I do not know how long I can last before someone wrests the reins of control from my hands. I do not even know if it is a mercy or a curse that he lives still. How long can this last? I do not know." Someone gasped for air. I glanced, startled, at Hyacinth. He leaned against the wall, fumbling to unfasten the velvet collar of his doublet, and his skin beneath its rich brown tone was a deadly grey. "Hyacinth!" I uttered his name in fear, hurrying to his side to aid him. He waved me away, doubling over, then straightening with a great indrawn breath. "3 days," he said, his voice faint. He steadied himself, reaching for the wall, and repeated it. "The king will die in 3 days, Your Highness." His gaze slid over toward Telesis. "You did bid me to use the Dromond, my lady." "What do you say?" Isandra's voice had gone as cold and hard as a scaldy winter. "You claim the gift of prophecy, son of Anastasia?" "I claim the Dromond, though I do not have my mother's skill at it." He passed his hands blindly over his face. "Your Highness, when blessed Eloa was weary, he sought sanctuary among the Tsingani in Bodistan, and we turned him out with jeers and stones, predicting in our pride that he and his companions would ever be cursed to wander the earth, doomed to call no place home. It is not wise to curse the son of Earth's womb. We were punished, the fate we decreed sealed as our own, condemned to walk the long road. But in her cruel mercy, the Mother of All granted us the Dromond, to part the veils of time, that next time we might see truer. Isandra stood unmoving, then turned purposefully to the Castellan brothers on guard. You will say nothing of this. I bid you by your oaths. They bowed, both of them, identical Castellan bows. Let us return. Her man-at-arms had come back by the time we arrived, a nervous-looking palace guard in tow. He took one look at Jocelyn and me, eyes widening.
Those are the ones, he said, certainty in his voice. Him in grey, and her in that dark red cloak. Asked to see the king's poet, but I thought...
Thank you. Isandra de la Courcelle inclined her head to him. You have done us a service. Understand that this is a matter of utmost secrecy, and to speak of it is treason and punishable by death. The guard gulped, swallowed, and nodded. I didn't blame him. She dismissed him then and had a quiet word with one of her own guardsmen. He would be followed, I guessed. We all stood quietly, forgotten, while Isandra paced the audience room, her face strained with grief.
Eloa, have mercy, she murmured to herself. Who do I trust? What must I do?
Remembering us, she caught herself and paused.
Forgive us our ingratitude. You have done us a service, a mighty service, and endured great hardship to do it. We are grateful, I assure you, and will see that your names are cleared, and reinstated with glory as heroes of the realm. You have the word of the throne upon it.
No, the word came automatically to my lips. I cleared my throat, disregarding Jocelyn and Hyacinth's incredulous stares.
My lady, your highness, you cannot, I said reluctantly. Isidore d'Eglamour is your first and closest enemy.
He has an army at his command, assembled and at the ready. You have but one advantage. He does not know you know him for a traitor. If you reveal it now, you force his hand. Now, before he does, gather those peers you trust and seek their counsel. If you do not marshal your strength, he will strike, and he may win. Even if he does not, it will lay Terre d'Ange bare for the Scaldi to plunder at will. Those cool purple eyes considered me.
Then you will still be named a murderess, Phaedra No de Launay, the engineer of your lord's demise, and your companions with you.
So be it. I straightened my backbone. Hyacinth's part is unknown. He is safe enough. Jocelyn, I glanced at him. He bowed to me with sorrow in his wry smile.
I am already condemned. I have broken every vow but one to get us here alive, your highness. I do not fear the judgment of Terre d'Ange, when a greater judgment awaits me, he said quietly.
Isandra stood silent, then nodded.
Understand, but I am grieved at this necessity.
There was dignity in her words and her bearing. I understood and believed. I could see in her the echo of the crown prince that de Launay had revered. I wondered what he had made of Roland's daughter. Then a calculating light lit her eyes. But you are too valuable to discard into safe exile, and you no less than the others, if your gift tells true, Tsingano. In the name of my grandfather, I place you all under the custody of the throne.
So it was done.
Chapter 58. Hyacinth had spoken truly. Ganelon de la Courcelle, king of Terre d'Ange, died in 3 days' time. I have little first-hand knowledge of what it was like in those days, being cloistered in the palace under the express care of Isandra's personal guard. Some news we gained from them, and from her chirurgeon, who examined us, treating Jocelyn's half-healed wounds and prescribing a rich diet to counter the toll of deprivation our long flight had taken. But for the most part, it felt as though I were confined in a dream, while the real world passed by me. We heard the morning bells toll that had not rung since I was a child at Sirius House. We saw the solemn faces of the guards and their black armbands. For all of that, it seemed unreal to me. One thing was sure, though. I could feel the uneasiness of the city, and the greater realm beyond it, on my very skin. Although they knew not the true threat that awaited, reports of Scaldi invasion increased, and Isidore de Glamour and a half-dozen other Carmeline nobles begged off attendance at the king's funeral and Isandra's coronation, claiming they dared not leave the province unguarded. The coronation itself was a hasty affair. After so long, no one truly believed Ganelon would die, and, too, illness had thinned the ranks of Dangeline nobles as well as the common folk. There were 5 empty seats or more in Parliament alone, and among those who remained to fill them, there was grave mistrust of the worth of a young and untried queen, who yet stood unwed and alone. These things I learned in some detail from Telesis de Mornay, who was permitted to visit us. She continued to mend from her bout with the fever, but slowly, and I cringed to hear her racking cough. Above all, I dreaded to hear word of Melisande Charizai. Though she was reported to be in Cushit, one of her cousins, Fanchone, came bearing flowery condolences on the part of House Charizai. It was within the palace walls that I had last encountered her, and it preyed on my mind in that place. I fingered her diamond that lay still at my throat, a talisman of vengeance that somehow I dared not discard, and thought of her too often. Survival in a hostile land takes up all of one's thought. Now I had too much time to think and remember. I had withheld the signal, it was true, but with Delaunay's blood as good as on her hands, I had given up everything else. She had played me like a harp, and I had sung to her tune. I could not forget, and it sickened me. It was Jocelyn who found a way out for me. He knew. He had walked with me into her hands, and been there when I'd awakened from it, retching and soul-sick. And he was that thing I ever forgot with Castellines, a priest. What he said somberly, not quite meeting my eyes. Fedra, you give Elowa his due, and Narmar, whose servant you are. But it is Kushiel who marked you, and Kushiel whose will you challenge when you despise what you are. He looked at me then, expression undecipherable. You will break, to challenge the will of the immortals. I know, I have been at the verge of it, and it was you who drew me back. But I cannot help in this. Beg leave to attend the temple of Kushiel. They will accept your atonement. This I did, and Isandra de la Courcelle granted me leave, provided I went hooded in the attendance of her personal guard. Of that I will say little. Those who have had need of Kushiel's harsh mercy know. Those who have not, need not know. Of all of Elowa's companions, Kushiel's disciples can be trusted beyond death with their vows of secrecy. Were it not so, no one would atone. Even his priests wear robes and full bronze masks, so that their identity cannot be discerned, nor even their gender. They looked at my face through the eye-holes of their masks when I raised my hood, saw the mark of Kushiel's dart, and took me in without question. It is a terrifying place, though a safe one, from all but the evil that one carries within oneself. I endured the rituals of purification, and then, cleansed and purged and stripped naked, knelt at the altar before the great bronze statue of Kushiel himself, serene and harsh, while 2 priests bound my wrists to the whipping post. There I made my confession, and was scourged. I am what I am. I can say now without shame that I wept with release at the first blow of the flogger, the iron-tipped lashes searing my skin. Pain and pain alone, pure and red, flooded me, washing away my guilt. Before me, Kushiel's stern face swam in the blood haze of my vision. Behind me, the same face was echoed in the bronze mask of the priest wielding the flogger, with a cruel and impersonal love.
My back was ablaze with agony, awful and welcome. I do not know how long it lasted. An eternity, it seemed, and yet not long enough. When the priest stopped, the leather straps of the flogger were wet with my own red blood, and drops of it spattered the altar.
"Be free of it," he murmured, voice muffled behind the mask.
Taking up a dipper, he plunged it into a font of salt water, pouring it over my flayed skin. I cried out as the pain multiplied fivefold, salting my open weals. Cried out and shuddered, the temple reeling in my vision. Thus did I make my atonement. When I returned to the safekeeping of the palace, I was calm with it, empty of the terrible sickness that had eaten at my heart for many days. Suffused with the simple languor of childhood after the Dawain's chastiser had done with me. Jocelyn glanced at my face once, then looked away. At that moment, I did not care. I was content. "News," Hyacinth informed me. It wasn't news that would wait. "The Dauphine, the Queen, I mean, has given out that she's retiring to one of the Courcelle estates to mourn for a fortnight. She's summoning a council of the peers she dares to trust, and we're to attend it." We went. The numbers, I sorrow to say, invited to attend that council were pathetically small. If it were a simple matter of state, I dare say Isandra would have trusted others, but the matter of Deglamore's betrayal was too grave. Telesis was there simply because the Queen trusted her. Gaspard Trevelyan, whom Delaunay had trusted. Percy de Somerville, who looked older than I remembered, and less hardy. Barquiel Lanvert, whom would not have trusted, were the choice mine. There were two only whom I did not know by sight, for they came seldom to the palace, though I had heard Delaunay speak of both with respect. The Duchesse Roxane de Merellio of Isande, who is called the Lady of Marsilicos, and Thibault of Sioval, the scholarly Comte de Toulard. Were it not for Ganelon's funeral and Isandra's coronation, they would not likely have been summoned so quickly. Also present was the prefect of the Castelline Brotherhood, tall and severe, with a face that looked carved of ancient ivory, and eyes like a stooping hawk's. Bound in a tight club, his hair was entirely white, with the yellow tinge that age sometimes brings, but his carriage was erect as a young man's. The estate that Isandra de la Courcelle had chosen was one of the king's hunting lodges in Lagnas. It was well done, I thought, for it was gracious and secluded, with a discreet staff that was removed from the arena of politics. Also it was not far from de Somerville's estate, and his long history of loyalty to the throne was beyond reproach. Lagnas in the person of de Somerville, Azal in the person of Trevelyan, and de Somerville Saint-Guilain by proxy. Namar, represented by Lanvert, and Isande and Sioval. Cushith, I thought, was not represented, nor was Cumlach. There was no one Isandra had dared trust. These tallies I made later, when the council had begun, for they assembled first, waiting on the Queen's arrival. She had chosen one of the larger rooms, comfortable and well-appointed, but informal. There were chairs and couches both, that guests might situate themselves as they chose. Light refreshments were served, and the wine poured, and then the servants withdrew. I was there when Isandra de la Courcelle entered, for she kept the three of us in attendance, not wanting word to leak in advance of her arrival. She bid her castellan guards, for she had inherited those who served the king, to await her outside, then stood before the doors and gathered herself, schooling her features to calm. No older than I am, I thought, and pitied her. But she was the queen. Isandra entered the room, the unlikely three of us in tow, and the queen's council was met. It was strange standing behind her, to see these seven peers come instantly to attention, offering deep bows and curtsies. "Rise, gentles," Isandra said. "We will not stand on ceremony here. You may find it difficult indeed when I have told you why I've asked you here."
"Phaedra!"
Gaspard Trevelyan's voice rang out with unadulterated surprise, and to my gratitude, joy.
He crossed the room with long strides, embracing me.
"You live,"
he said, taking my shoulders and looking to make sure it was I.
"Blessed Eloa, you live!"
Barkiel Lanvert approached, with a smile that did not reach his eyes.
"De Launay's Anguisset," he drawled, "and the Castelline. Didn't you enjoy my largesse in the Caliph's court? I heard I sent you to Kebeli Markad, after paying you to betray your master."
I turned toward him, but Jocelyn stepped forward.
"Your Grace," he said in his even tone, "it is not a matter for jesting."
Lanvert gave him a long, gauging look.
"You've grown some spurs, lad. Well, I hope you've brought them to clear my name, Isandra."
"It is one reason, but the least of them, I fear," she murmured.
"My Lord Rinfort,"
Jocelyn's voice held all the relieved surrender I'd felt at Kushiel's temple. I looked and saw why. He had recognized the prefect. He went to kneel at the prefect's feet, crossing his forearms and bowing his head.
"My Lord Rinfort," he said formally, "I am in violation of my sworn vows. I remand myself to your justice."
"You stand condemned of betraying the household you swore to protect and serve, Jocelyn Verai," the prefect said grimly. "That is no mere violation, young brother."
"Of that he is innocent,"
Isandra de la Courcelle raised her voice. It carried clearly, reminding them that they stood in the presence of the queen.
"My Lord Rinfort, the integrity of your order is unbreached. Believe me when I tell you that I wish it were not so. Hear their story and judge."
And so we told it once more. They listened in silence and varying degrees of disbelief. For that I did not blame them. Isandra had been right. They took to their seats as the tale unfolded. I didn't blame them for that either. It was a long story and hard to hear. When we were done, there was silence. I could not read most of their faces, not even Gaspard Trevelyan's, who'd been like an uncle to me. Those I could did not bode well.
"Surely, Isandra," Barkiel Lanvert said with deceptive insouciance, "you don't expect us to believe this ludicrous confabulation?"
Of all of them, he lounged at his ease on a couch, dangerous as a hunting leopard, toying idly with the ends of his burnous that lay unwrapped about his neck. I could see only the danger in him, but he was Isandra's nearest kin.
"Not on their word alone,"
her voice held firm, and she lifted her chin on her elegant corselle neck.
"My guard has asked questions, as discreetly as they dared. There are four among the palace guard who saw them that night, seeking audience as they claim, and one indeed who saw them in the presence of Melisande Charizai. They were examined by my own personal physician, who has attended me since childhood, and he will testify that their condition was consonant with the hardship they claimed to have endured, from exposure to direst cold, down to the wheels on Jocelyn Verai's wrists, where he was confined in chains."
"And yet these things may have other explanations, and other causes," murmured the Comte de Toulard, his expression thoughtful.
"They may," Isandra said, "yet the most damning piece of evidence in their conviction was their absence. Here they stand before us."
"Is there no other evidence that we may consider?"
Roxane de Merelio inquired. Past the age when suitors battened the walls of Marsilicos, she retained a lush, rounded beauty, streaks of white in her coal-black hair. I liked her, for her dark eyes were both kind and clever.
"Yes, my lady," I said, curtsying to her. "You may send to the Comte de Bois-le-Garde of Cumlach, whose men came upon us in the woods. Or," I added, glancing dourly at Barkiel Lanvert, "you may venture into the Scaldy lands, if you wish. I can point out Gunter Arnlaugsen's steading on a map. It is no difficulty. Ask him about the Dangeline slaves he bought from Carmeline soldiers, if you so desire."
"And if it's true, either way we show our hand to Deglamore, if we're not killed for our troubles," Barkiel remarked, scratching his cropped fair hair. "So odd to see on a Dangeline nobleman." But whether I trusted him or no, he was no fool. A pretty trap, if you've laid it. Delaunay taught you well. If it's not, Eloa help us all.
Eloa help us indeed,
Gaspard Trevelyan said quietly.
I have known Phaedra no Delaunay since she was a child, and I cannot believe she would be party to Onarfiel Delaunay's murder. If that is so, then she tells the truth, as she believes it. And as for the Castelline, look at him, Barkiel. He bears his honesty on his face.
I do not know you, he added to Hyacinth, but I see no gain in this for you. Hyacinth cleared his throat, flushing slightly at the company he addressed.
I have known Phaedra longer than anyone, he said, even Delaunay. I saw her the night they returned to the city. She does not lie.
But why, Thibault de Toulard said in his thoughtful manner, would Isidore d'Eglamour desire Delaunay's death? Gaspard Trevelyan and Telesis de Mornay exchanged a glance, but it was Isandre de la Courcelle who answered, colour rising to stain her alabaster skin.
Because, she said with dignity, I asked his aid in a certain matter, which d'Eglamour may have believed dangerous to his plans.
No, Barkiel Lanvert came upright on his couch. Oh, no, you can't mean to abide by it.
I can, she said, eyes blazing at him, and I do.
No, he glared back at her. If there's a measure of truth to this tale, Isandra, I can arrange a union with the Prince of the Royal House of Aragon, who can bring 2,000 spears to your aid.
The Lioness of Arzal, Gaspard Trevelyan remarked conversationally, came a great deal closer to overthrowing the crown than anyone realized. If she had succeeded in bringing the army of Malcolm the Usurper, the old Cruach's son, across the strait, they would have swept across the country like a scythe.
Percy de Somerville shook his gold-grey head, speaking for the first time.
"They'd have taken us unprepared, but they wouldn't have made it across. Guillain tried near the same tactic at the king's command. The master of the straits left no vessel unturned."
"No one can say why the master of the straits chooses as he does," Thibault de Toulard mused. "He let the old Cruach cross, and no one knew why. If they had succeeded..."
A thought came to him, and he paled.
"But they did not, because of Isidore d'Eglamour and Melisande Charizai. My Lady Isandra, what have you to do with that fateful island of Alba, and what has it to do with the death of Onarfiel Delaunay de Montrève?"
I repeated the name silently, wondering, "Montrève?"
Isandra de la Courcelle folded her hands in her lap, lifting her chin again. "At the age of 16, she said quietly, "I was promised to the Cruach's heir, his sister's son, Drustin Mab Nectana, the Prince of the Cruinia." There is a thing that happens when a truth suddenly comes clear, a white blaze in which the pattern of it all manifests. I saw it then, in the presence of the Queen's Council.
"Delaunay!" I gasped the word, an agony of grief. "Ah, Eloa, the message! Quintilius Rouse, the master of the straits, you sought passage for him, for the Pictish prince, to d'Angeline soil. But why turn to Delaunay?"
"Onarfiel Delaunay de Montrève." Isandra gave me the ghost of a smile. "You never even knew his proper name, did you? His father, who is the Comte de Montrève, abjured him, when he tied his fate to my father's and forbore to get heirs. He took his mother's name as his own then, for she loved him nonetheless. My Lord de Toulard would know, being of Siovale."
"Sarafiel Delaunay,"
Roxanne de Morelio, the Lady of Marsilicos, said unexpectedly, smiling. "She was Isandine by birth. There is an old story in Isande of Eloa and a fisher lad named Delaunay. Sarafiel would have understood. She sent Onarfiel to me to be fostered when he was a child."
"Blessed Eloa!"
It was almost too much information to bear, and I pressed the heels of my hands to my eyes. I felt Hyacinth steady me, gripping my arms, and was grateful for it.
"My grandfather was already using Delaunay," Isandra said, continuing ruthlessly. He didn't favour him, but he knew the strength of his oath and the extent of his discretion. It was his will to learn if there was any merit left in an alliance with a deposed heir. I wanted somewhat else. Her composure slipped a little bit, and she whispered the last words, Drustan Mab Nectina. Her words created a silence almost as great as Jocelyn's and mine had, broken by Barkia Lanvert's abrupt laugh.
The blue boy? He asked, disbelieving. You really want to wed the blue boy?
Isandra's eyes flared into life. I want to wed the rightful heir to the kingdom of Alba, to whom I am betrothed. Yes, uncle, and it is to that end that Anarfiel de Launay worked, and it is to prevent it that he was killed.
But what?
It was Lord Rinfort who spoke, the prefect of the Castelline Brotherhood, his jaw working as he attempted to make sense of what had been said.
What has this to do with the Scaldi and the Duke de Glamour?
Nothing, Isandra said gently, or everything. It was then that I knew we would be a long time meeting. A very long time. Chapter 59. I will confess, like the others, I could not fathom Isandra's will in honouring her betrothal to the Prince of the Picti. A year ago the romance of it might well have swept me away, but I had since been a barbarian lord's bedslave, and my blood was soured on the romance of the exotic. Still, when she spoke of it, I came to some sympathy, for she spoke with precision and passion, rising to pace restlessly. All my life, she announced, her hands clasped behind her back as she walked, chin tilted, I have been a pawn in the game of alliance by marriage. I have been courted and besuited and fated by Dangeline lordlings, who saw in me only a path to the throne, grasping inbred creatures, jaded to everything but power. The Cruinia did not come for power. They came following a dream, a vision so strong it swayed the master of the straits to allow them passage. Isandra glanced at Telesis de Mornay as she said those words, and a memory sparked in me. Delaunay's courtyard, after the audience with the Cruach. I heard Alcuin's voice echo in my mind. Still, I heard somewhat of a vision of the king's sister, a black boar and a silver swan. A black boar. I mouthed the words to myself, repeating them silently in Cruinia. Black boar. The queen's council stirred, most of them uncomfortable with talk of visions. Drustan Mab Nectina does not desire rulership of Terre d'Ange, Isandra said firmly. We spoke of it, laughing in broken tongues. A dream of the two of us grown, ruling our kingdoms in tandem. The idle dreams of romantic youth, yes, but there was truth in it. And I saw in him somewhat that I could love, and he in me. When he spoke of Alba, his eyes lit like stars. I am not prepared to abandon this alliance for mere political expediency.
You are the queen, my dear. Roxanne de Morelio murmured. You may not have the luxury of choosing.
The House of Aragon, Lanvert began.
The Lady of Marsilicos cut him short. The House of Aragon will send aid if we are invaded by the Scaldi, for they know where the Scaldi would turn next if Terre d'Ange falls. But the immediate danger lies within our own borders. She looked at Isandra, her dark eyes rich with sorrow. The simplest solution, my dear, is for you to marry Isidore de Glamour.
And set a traitor on the throne?
The Comte de Sommerville was outraged.
If what they say is true.
If it is true, Roxanne interrupted, and our first duty is to determine if it is, then we have no choice but to bind his loyalty by any means possible. It is that or conquest. There were murmurs, grudging ones, of agreement. Isandra paled, the blood draining from her face. No, I said, whispering the word. Conversation halted, and they stared at me. That would not be the end of it, The Scaldi threat remains, and it is 10 times more dire than anything Isidore d'Eglamour could muster. And there is Melisande. She has a private correspondence with the Scaldi, with Voldemar Selig, routed through Caedica Unitas. I have seen their numbers. If they know themselves betrayed, not even the full loyalty of the allies of Cumlach can save us.
Then we will take Melisande Charizai into custody,
Lord Rinfort, the prefect, said brusquely.
It is a simple enough matter.
I laughed hollowly. My lord, oh my lord, there are no simple matters with Melisande Charizai. Do you think it is an accident that she is in Kushith and not the city? I would not wager upon it.
But why?
Thibaut de Toulard pulled at his braid, a scholar's abstract gesture, frowning.
Why would she betray the realm? What stakes are worth such risk?
They looked at me then, all of them. My hand stole up to close around her diamond, and I closed my eyes. Not one realm, but two, lie at stake. But it is the game, and not the stakes, I murmured, when you come to it. The Charizai have played the game of houses since Eloa's footsteps echoed across the land, and Melisande plays it better than anyone. I opened my eyes and gazed back at them. She has made her mistake. I am the proof of it, and this slight advantage we bear as its sole outcome. Do not count on her to make another, and if you take the Duke d'Eglamour to be our greatest foe, I fear it will be our undoing. Voldemar Selig is no fool either.
We cannot ignore a province in revolt, Percy de Somerville protested. And we cannot know for sure that Cumlach is in rebellion, Barquiel Lanvert said pragmatically. That, then, is our first order of business, establishing the truth of this confabulation. Without, of course, de Toulard reminded him, tipping our hand. Of course, Lanvert inclined his head, only slightly sardonic.
Gaspard Trevelyan scratched his chin.
Where, he asked Percy de Somerville, are Prince Baudouin's glory-seekers now? D'Eglamour petitioned the king for them. You ought to know, the one-time royal commander said sourly. In Trevelyan, under Guilain's command, making trouble. I wonder Mark suffered their insubordinacy. My cousin was always a patient man, Gaspar grinned. He survived marriage to Leonette, didn't he? This is my thought. Send d'Eglamour the glory seekers. Let him think the queen is softer than her grandfather was. Baudouin's guard bear no love for Isidore d'Eglamour, who brought down their prince and disgraced their name. Let them dissemble. Let them ride the length of Cumlach and see where loyalties lie.
And what is to guarantee their loyalty? Roxane de Morelio inquired. It was House Courcelles that had Baudouin de Trevelyan executed.
Ah, Gaspard said softly. Yes. Ganelon de la Courcelle. But it is Isandre de la Courcelle who could recall Duke Marc de Trevelyan and his daughter Bernadette from exile. And strip my son Guilain of his estates? Percy de Somerville asked dangerously.
Gaspard Trevelyan looked evenly at him.
I have heard great things of your son, my lord de Somerville, but he is a scion of Arneil, and they will never love him in Azal, whose sin is pride. Never, unless he were to become one of them, to wed, let us say, a Trevelyan. Bernadette? Even so.
Isandra followed the exchange with acute attention, her face grave. Azal holds the flatlands, and we cannot risk dissension there, she said calmly. My lord de Forsay, your cousin has committed a crime against the throne in withholding knowledge of Lionette's plan. If he were given a chance at redemption, would he take it?
Your Majesty. Gaspard Trevelyan, the Comte de Forsay, bowed to her. He is a d'Angeline in exile. Yes, he would take it. And this I swear to you, upon my name, that he would be twice fierce in his loyalty,
for being given a chance to prove it. Never while you live will House Trevelyan give you cause to regret this clemency."
She was young. She bit her lip, then nodded.
"Let it be so, then. You know where he resides?"
She glanced at Gaspar, who inclined his head.
"We will communicate with him, then. But let the offer be made to Baudouin's guard first, and let them understand that upon their loyalty and their discretion rests the redemption of their house. Will you undertake this, my lord?"
"I will," Gaspar said firmly.
"Good." Isandra looked stronger for the resolution. "Now I have spoken with Prince Benedict of these matters, in so far as I dared. You should know he and my uncle the Duke have made peace between them."
She glanced at Barquiel Lanvert, who nodded curtly, no mockery in his expression. It was well done, I thought, impressed that she had brought them to Concord. Oh, they had underestimated her direly, those d'Angelines who had called for Baudouin to replace her. There was steel indeed in Isandre de la Courcelle.
"La Serenissima cannot aid us with men," she continued. "They are too near the Scaldic border, at too great a risk themselves. But they can aid us with intelligence, and that Benedict has sworn to do." She gazed round at the others. "We require knowledge, my lords and ladies, knowledge of Aragonia's support and the other Caerdyche city-states. Knowledge of the movements of the Scaldi, knowledge of the loyalties within our own realm, knowledge of the extent of the forces we can marshal and the degree of their readiness. This knowledge we require, and we require that it be obtained in secrecy. What are you prepared to do?"
I will not detail the conversation that followed, for it was lengthy and complicated. In the end, it was resolved that each of them would take various measures toward these ends, moving with the utmost of discretion. The Castellan Brotherhood would serve as the conduit for this intelligence, forming a network of couriers to carry information to all the provinces. This was well conceived, for no one would suspect the Castellans of politicking. Indeed, I think the prefect would not have agreed, were he not anxious to remove the taint that Jocelyn's actions had cast upon his order. It was resolved, too, that no word would be given on the matter of the alleged traitors, until such time as there was proof at hand, and an advantage to be gained in revealing it. When it was done, it was Barquiel Lanvert who returned to the topic of Alba.
"Well, Isandre," he said wryly, "we have planned our first steps toward handling civil war and invasion as best we may. What of your blue lad? How stand matters on fair Alba?"
It was Gaspar Trevelyan who answered, rubbing at the bridge of his nose. Everyone was weary by this time.
"Drustan Mab Nectaner escaped the bloodbath and fought his way, with his mother and sisters and a handful of warriors, to the western side of Alba, to seek refuge among the Dalriada. This we know. If the Dalriada would fight for him, it is likely that he could retake the throne from his cousin Maelcon, but thus far they have refused."
"Yes," Barquiel replied sarcastically. "I'm aware of this, as is much of the realm, as was Ganelon, which is why he was inclined to break their betrothal, which, of course, was never made public in the first place. Is this the extent of your vast intelligence for which Arnulfiel de Launay was slain?"
"No,"
Telesis de Mornay intervened softly, but with the poet's command of tone that summoned their attention. "De Launay was in contact with Quintilius Rouse, who carried a request to the Master of the Straits. We pleaded that he grant passage to Drustan Mab Nectaner and his folk. Were they to gain d'Angeline soil, he and Isandre could wed. Terre d'Ange would aid him in regaining the throne of Alba, and Alba would aid Isandre in retaining the throne of Terre d'Ange."
"The very plan of the Lioness of Azal," Roxanne de Morelio murmured.
"Which nigh succeeded," Gaspar reminded her. "Yes, except we sought the compliance of the Master of the Straits."
"Which," Thibaut de Toulard observed, "I take it he did not give."
"He answered thusly," Telesis said, and quoted,
When the Black Boar rules in Alba, Elder Brother will accede. Those were the words of Quintilius Rous, and the message for which Delaunay was killed. I knew the words, knew them well, and yet they tugged at my mind, an echoing memory.
A message which makes no sense, Lambert said acerbically.
Not so, Telesis shook her head. There are dozens of tribes in Alba and Era, but they fall into four peoples. The folk of the Red Bull, to whom Maelcon and Fochleda are born. The folk of the White Mare, whom the Dalriada follow. The folk of the Golden Hind to the south, and the folk of the Black Boar, to whom Drustin Mab Nectina was born. Kinnel Rue's line. The Master of the Straits is saying that he will grant our request if Prince Drustin can reclaim Alba.
Ah, well then, Lambert shrugged. Likely he would grant our request if Blessed Eloa returned from the Terre d'Ange that lies beyond and ask him a boon. It is a moot point.
The memory that had evaded me at last came clear. Do not discount the Culloch Gorim, I said aloud. Hyacinth, I shook him in my excitement. Do you remember? Your mother said it to me. Do not discount the Culloch Gorim, I repeated it. Don't discount the Black Boar.
He frowned. I remember. It didn't make any sense.
It does now, I said. It means Prince Drustin. You say your mother had this gift? Isandra asked, bending her gaze on Hyacinth.
Yes, Your Majesty, he bowed, greater than I. And she said this. It is true.
What do you see? He stared into the distance, his black eyes going black and filmy, and finally shook his head.
I see a ship, he said reluctantly. Nothing more. Where the paths branch in many ways, I cannot see far.
It is only the straight road I see clearly, Majesty, such as your grandfather the King's.
Anyone could have foretold that, Percy de Somerville muttered. Ganelon was on his deathbed.
The young Tsingano foretold the day of it, Isandra reminded him. She looked thoughtful. If the Dalriada knew of the Master of the Straits pledge, mayhap they would lend Drustin their aid. Arnafiel de Launay would have gone, had he not been killed. It is a pity, for he spoke Cruinia, and his young pupil as well. And there is no one else I trust. She glanced apologetically at Telesis. I do not speak of you, of course. I trust you with my life, Queen's Poet, and I know your spirit is willing. But I have spoken with the physicians, and a winter voyage across land and sea would be the death of you, Telesis.
So they tell me, Telesis de Mornay murmured, and I did not doubt that she was willing to go anyway, though the ravages of the fever were clearly marked on her strained features. But her dark luminous gaze fell on me instead. My lady, she said to Isandre, Arnafiel de Launay had two pupils. The shock of it went clean through me.
What are you saying? I whispered.
I am saying, she had to pause, overcome by a fit of coughing.
Phaedra no de Launay, you could take Arnafiel's place as the Queen's ambassador. My lady, I protested, looking from Telesis to Isandra, not sure which one of them I was addressing. My mind was reeling. My lady, I am an Anguisset. I am trained to be a servant of Narmar. I'm not trained to be an ambassador.
Whatever you're trained to do, you apparently do it damnably well, Barquier Lambert remarked laconically. Did you know Rogier Clavel went into mourning for you and lost some 20 pounds? He's as thin as a rail these days. Any pupil of Arnafiel de Launay's is considerably more than a servant of Narmar, little Anguisset. You're the first whore I've heard of to double-cross a Scaldi war leader and survive to warn a nation of treason.
My lord, I heard the terror in my own voice. What I did to survive, I hope never to do again. I do not have the strength to live through it twice.
The Cruinia are not the Scaldi, Isandra said reasonably, and you would be under the protection of Quintilius Rous, who is one of the greatest admirals ever to set sail.
Fedra. For what you have done, I am grateful. Never think it is not so. I would not ask this thing if our need were not urgent. I sat without answering, unseeing with shock. Near to me, Jocelyn rose, giving his smooth, castellan bow to the Queen. He turned to me then, and I gazed up at him, his face shining with bright fearlessness.
"Fedra," he said, his voice ringing with a hero's courage, "we have survived worse adventures. I will go with you. I have sworn it, to protect and serve."
For a moment his courage kindled my own. Then the prefect's voice came hard on the heels of Jocelyn's ringing tones, like a dash of icy water.
"Brother Jocelyn," he said crisply, "we are glad that your innocence has been established in the matter of Anafiel de Launay's death. But you have confessed yourself in violation of your vows and remanded yourself to our justice. For the salvation of your soul, you must atone and be shriven. Only those who strive to be perfect companions are fit to serve the scions of Elwar."
Jocelyn blinked, staring at him open-mouthed, then regained his composure. "My lord prefect," he said with a bow, "I am sworn still to the household of Anafiel de Launay." There was a note of anguish in his voice. "If there is salvation to be found for me, it lies in honouring that vow."
"You are relieved of your vow to de Launay's household," the prefect said flatly. "I decree it so."
"My lord," Jocelyn winced as if struck. "My lord prefect, please, no." The old prefect levelled his hawk's glare at Jocelyn.
"What transgressions have you committed, young brother?"
Jocelyn looked away, unable to hold the prefect's gaze. "I have failed to safeguard my charge," he said dully. "I have slain in anger instead of defending. I have committed murder. And I have..." He looked at me for a moment, his expression grave. I remembered Elwa's cavern, and what had happened between us there. Then his gaze slid away from mine, and he glanced at Hyacinth.
"I have drawn my sword merely to threaten," he finished. "These are grave sins," the prefect shook his head. "I cannot allow it, Brother Jocelyn. Another will go in your stead."
It was very still in the king's hunting lodge. No one, not even Isandra, would intervene in a castling matter. Jocelyn stood alone, lost in thought. He raised his blue gaze toward the ceiling, then looked once again at me. I remembered him standing alone in the deadly veils of snow, casting down his sword before the Scaldi. He had made choices no other castellan ever had faced. He had been tempered by chains and blood and ice, and not broken. I did not want any other protector to stand in his stead.
"Your Majesty," Jocelyn turned to Isandra with a bow, speaking with the utmost formality, "will you accept my sword in your service as the protector of Fedrano de Launay?" "Do it and be damned, young brother," the prefect said harshly. "Cassiel's vows bind for a lifetime and beyond."
Isandra de la Courcelle sat in consideration, her face expressionless. At last she inclined her head. "We accept your service," she said formally. To the prefect she said, "My lord Rinfort, we grieve to cross your wishes, but we must follow the precepts of blessed Elwa in such matters, and not the will of the castellan brotherhood. And by Elwa's teaching, he is free to choose his course."
"There will be a reckoning upon the misguided," the prefect muttered through clenched teeth. "So be it. Is that your will, Brother Jocelyn?"
"It is." Jocelyn's voice sounded hollow, but he stood unwavering. The prefect gave an immaculate castellan bow, then made a gesture with both hands, as though breaking something.
"Jocelyn Verai of the Castellan Brotherhood, I declare you anathema."
He bowed again to Isandra.
"I demand this man into your service, Your Majesty."
"Good," she said simply. "Fedrano de Launay, do you accept this charge to take up your lord's duty and carry my words to Prince Drustin Mab Nectina of the Cruinia?" After what Jocelyn had done,
it left me little choice. I stood, my stomach a mix of sinking terror, pride, and excitement, and made obeisance to my queen.
"Yes, Your Majesty, I will go."
"Good," Isandra repeated, adding thoughtfully, "then the only problem that remains is how to get you safely to Quintilius Rouse."
"Where is he?"
I knew where he had been. I dreaded the answer.
"Kushith."
The word fell like a stone.
"Your Majesty," Hyacinth said unexpectedly, "I have an idea."
Chapter 60. It seemed that there was a Tsingani route to Kushith, something neither I nor anyone else in the Queen's Council had known. The Tsingani live among the Dongelines and travel our roads, and yet we know little of their ways. Hyacinth knew. It had always been his half-secret passion, while he played in Knight's doorstep at being the Prince of Travellers, to claim his birthright from his grandfather's Kumpania. I think, other than his mother, only I knew it. They are great horse traders, the Tsingani, and breeders as well. Isand boasts the most famous, for they are dearly sought after by the Torieras who perform their deadly games with the great Isandine bulls. But inland, Kushith holds another great centre of Tsingani horse breeding. And some few of the Kumpanias journey there in early spring to have their pick of the first foaling. This was the essence of Hyacinth's plan, that we should journey to Kushith along Tsingani-marked roads, seeking his people, the Kumpania of Manoj. And when we found them, he reckoned, we could beg or buy their aid in travelling as horse traders to the Point d'Ouest, where Rouse's fleet was beached. It was a dangerous plan, for it meant we would be isolated and vulnerable. And it was an excellent plan, for it cast us in a guise no one would expect. That, more than anything else, was what swayed the odds in favour of Hyacinth's plan. If there was one thing that terrified me above all others, it was not daring the wrath of the Master of the Straits, nor the dangers of distant Alba and the blue-tattooed Kruinia. It was venturing through Kushith, the homeland of House Sharizai. But no Kushaline lordling, I thought, not even Melisande, would think to examine the eyes of a young Tsingano woman for the telltale scarlet mote. So it was decided. The details of the matter were established after the Queen's Council had adjourned, all of us sworn to secrecy and loyalty. We met, after a fine dinner, only a handful of us, Gaspar and Telesis, who had been party to the Alban plan since the beginning, and Jocelyn, Hyacinth, and I. It would be a week's time before we could set out, for it was early yet, and only the eagerest of the Kumpanias would be on the road. And, too, there were some arrangements to be made. Hyacinth and Telesis would return to the city to procure what was needful. When all was decided, we had some leisure to talk.
"Fedra," Gaspar Trevelyan said, taking my hands in his, "I've not had time to tell you how deeply grieved I am at the death of Anarfiel de Launay. He was my friend, and a finer one I never had. The world is the less for the loss of his brilliant mind and his great heart. And Alcuin, I knew him from a boy, you know. He was a rare jewel."
"Thank you, my lord." I wrung his hands in gratitude, tears stinging my eyes. "De Launay always counted you one of the best among men."
"I thought he was a fool sometimes," Gaspar said gruffly, "honouring an oath sworn to a dead man. It demanded a great deal, that honour of his."
"Yes."
I thought of the bitter words I'd spoken to Isandra de la Courcelle at our first audience. "But," I said, "I loved him for it too."
"We all did," Telesis said, and smiled. "At least those who did not hate him, for he drew strong emotions, de Launay did. Fedra, his house and his things were seized by the court. Have you nothing to call your own?" I shook my head, fingering Melisande's diamond. "Only this," I said wryly, "which surely I earned.
It seems I will wear it until the day I may throw it back at her who gave it me. But I lost little to the courts. Nearly all that I had went to Master Robert Tielar, to contract for the finishing of my mark. I looked over my shoulder and shrugged. That loss I lay at the doorstep of Melisande Charizai and Isidore de Glamour.
"I swear," Gaspard Trevelyan said solemnly, giving my hands another squeeze, "on the memory of Anafiel de Launay. While I live, you will never lack for aught, Fedra. And when this matter is done, I will see your name cleared." He glanced at Jocelyn. "Both of yours."
"Thank you." I leaned forward and kissed his cheek, which had grown seamed with age since I had known him. Jocelyn, silent and introspective, nodded his gratitude.
"It seems to me," Hyacinth remarked, "that we might claim a considerable reward from the Queen for this service, yes?"
He looked at our startled faces and grinned.
"If you are to travel amongst Tsingani, you must begin thinking like one."
I could see the distaste on Jocelyn's face. "Better than thinking as one of the White Brethren," I said to him in Skaldic. His blue eyes widened for an instant, shocked to hear words in our slave tongue, then he smiled reluctantly.
"Will you teach me to speak Cruinia, as you did Skaldic?" he inquired lightly.
"I don't know," I said. "Do I have to have you chained in a kennel to make a willing pupil of you?"
"No," he said wryly, and ran his hands absently over his hair, which fell wheat-gold and loose over his shoulders, unbound from its castelline club. "I think I have learned the merits and the dangers of paying heed to your words, Fedra no de Launay. Your lord would be proud of you."
"Mayhap." I met his eyes. "Thank you," I said softly. We had not spoken of the choice he had made. Jocelyn looked away, picking with his thumbnail at a flaw in the carven arm of his chair.
"Well," he murmured, "I could not leave you to suffer the guardianship of some dried-up old stick of a castelline."
He looked at Hyacinth and smiled.
"And the brothers would despair of you, Tsingano. I may at least hope to survive our companionship without being driven mad."
"I hope so," Hyacinth flashed his imperturbable grin. "You've come a long way since Fedra had to rescue you from the degradations of Eglantine tumblers, castelline. I hope we face nothing worse together."
"Eloa grant that it's so."
Jocelyn stood, bowing, catching himself out with crossed arms. He shook his head.
"Forgive me. It's late, and I've need of sleep."
We bid him good night and watched him go.
"You know," Telesis said in her soft, compelling voice, "I had a great uncle who was a castelline. There is a name for what he did today."
She looked at me with those darkly luminous eyes in her wasted face.
"They call it Castiel's choice."
I did not need her to explain. I understood. The days that followed passed in relative isolation, as our forces dispersed to the four corners of the realm. At my request, Isandra had several volumes sent from the Royal Library, texts on Alba and books in Cruinia, and treatises on the Master of the Straits. I wished I had Delaunay's library at hand. I remembered how Alcuin was studying the history of the Master of the Straits, and wished he were there. I wished, too, that I had been present at that fateful audience, when Ganelon de la Courcelle had received the old Cruach. But no, Alcuin had gone with Delaunay, and I had been glad of it, going instead to Valyrian House, to dote over flagellaries and pleasure chambers. Such things seemed as child's play to me now. I knew firsthand the ravages that could be perpetuated against the soul. The torments of the flesh were as nothing to them. On the fourth day, Isandra summoned me into her presence. "I have brought someone to see you, Fedra," she said judiciously. "Someone whom I have gauged worthy of trust." It was my first thought that it was Cecily Laveau-Perrin, for I had missed her sorely since returning to Terdange,
and Telesis had confessed to me that she had confided in Cecily, who had wept tears of joy to hear that I was alive. But Isandra beckoned, and the frail figure that stepped forth was not Cecily. It was Master Tialar, the Marquist. I knelt at the sight of him, my eyes blurred with tears, grasping his gnarled hands and kissing them. He drew them back, fussing.
"Always this," he complained with anguissets. "My grandpère warned me it was so. Well, child, we have a contract unfulfilled between us, and my queen commands me to see it finished. Will you disrobe, or have these old bones make this journey for nothing?"
Still kneeling, I gazed through tear-flooded eyes at Isandra.
"Thank you, Your Majesty."
"You should thank me," she smiled faintly. "Master Tialar was not easy to persuade, but it is best to start a journey with all unfinished business concluded, and Telesis de Mornay told me of yours." She left us then, and the servants of the lodge led us to a private room, where the Marquist's things had been laid out for him. They even had a table made ready. I stripped naked and lay down upon it. He grumbled at the nearly healed wheels left by the priests of Kushiel's temple, but it seemed I would do. "Where is your apprentice, Master Tialar?" I asked him as he parted, muttering among his things.
"Gone," he said shortly. "The fever took him. You will be my last great work, Anguisset. I am too old to start anew, training one to take my place."